Hello, welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Heritage Radio Network's Farm Report. You're here with Heather Hyman, and today you are listening to me speak with Gwen Chance, the farm manager here at Roberta's Restaurant. And she is here also with her intern, Viola, of Brooklyn College. And we have a pretty exciting show today. We're going to have some guests coming in a little bit later on to talk about Sugar Shack and maple syrup production up in Montreal, which is associated with the restaurant Au Pied des Cochons. So they'll be joining us in just a bit. We'll start off by saying that I just learned very recently that we now broadcast beneath a rooftop farm. A couple weeks ago, you probably heard us saying that we've been broadcasting beneath a rooftop garden. And Gwen's going to explain to us how we came to be broadcasting beneath a farm instead of a garden.
Well, basically, the USDA designates anything a farm if it produces over $1,000 worth of produce. So that could be vegetables or meat or eggs or any food, basically. So we're a farm because we're producing, or we aim to be producing, at least $3,000 worth of food this year. And last year we didn't produce that much. And this year we're expanding quite a bit. And with help from interns like Biola and other volunteers, we're going to be growing into a 5,400 square foot lot next door. So wow. We are officially a farm.
Officially a farm. So from what I understand, this whole project originally started with volunteers. Is that true? And members of the restaurant?
That's right. A couple of the restaurant's owners were interested in growing some food, and they started with just a few pots, really, and they ended up installing a large garden on the roof of this very radio station, and it's all been volunteer labor all along, and it wasn't until a couple months ago that my position, farm manager, became necessary because we're expanding so quickly.
And there's so much work to be done. I mean, from the beginning till now, I mean, we have definitely lots more infrastructure than what was originally up above us. I know that it started off with just a few raised beds, which they planted, the soil first, and they've been composting and all things like that. So compared to last year's crops, what are you planning to do with what you'll start to, I guess, begin planting now as you expand this rooftop garden into the lot behind us the rooftop farm into the lot behind us, which will be an even bigger farm?
We're going to be planting a lot of the same types of vegetables that we did last year. It's a lot of greens, it's tomatoes, there's going to be onions and carrots, and just kind of your standard New England Northeast vegetable variety. What's different about the farm this year is that we're expanding, we're trying to grow as much as possible and produce as much food as possible, but at the same time, our farm space is going to be used as an event space. So everything from the plant beds themselves to the compost needs to be kind of event friendly. There's going to be people having weddings out here.
Wow.
So the compost can't be swarming with flies and stinky. So we've been working on, we've been doing some research. Biola has been helping me to try and find ways to minimize flies and reduce the odor of the compost so we can make the farm productive, but also kind of family friendly.
Definitely. Now, with the crops that you are going to be raising, what do you expect to do with them? I mean, are you going to be selling them? Will you be using them in the restaurant? Are you going to set up some kind of CSA in this area?
All of the vegetables that we produce are going to be used directly in the restaurant. And that's how we can kind of justify the cost of having the farm. It's not cheap to rent space in New York City, as everybody knows. So we need to make as much money off of each square foot as possible. So when we process the vegetables that we grow in our farm here at the restaurant, we add a lot of value. So a couple of heads of lettuce that we grow in the garden might sell for a few dollars at the farmer's market, but once we process them in the kitchen and sell them retail in the restaurant, we end up adding a lot of value to those vegetables.
Yeah, and then you're definitely becoming a much more like farm to fork type restaurant, I mean, to the fullest.
Yeah, it doesn't really get any more local than this.
Definitely. I mean, I just came back from the Georgia Organics Conference about 2 weeks ago, where I was sitting at a table with, you know, some well-known chefs that travel, you know, all across the country. And, you know, they were so impressed by Georgia's, like farm to table restaurants, like in that small area. And the only other place that they could really compare that to was in Portland, Oregon. Like, you know, how many restaurants are really able to produce so much from their menu straight mm-hmm. from the farm. And in New York City, it seems that it's really hard to do that. And luckily, you guys are going to be able to do most of your produce directly from your farm.
There aren't that many restaurants in New York that are doing it. There are definitely a few that have herb gardens right outside and they cut from their gardens. And even we aren't going to be able to produce the majority of the vegetables that we go through. It just takes such a large quantity of food. We do buy most of our produce from local sustainable farms. We get a lot of the restaurant's produce from Lancaster Farms. It's a farmer cooperative down in Amish country in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
It's all sustainably grown. So we do buy local when we have to buy produce, but yeah, we're trying to grow as much as we can on site. And it is hard in New York because of the climate. In places like Georgia or Oregon and in Northern California, you see a lot of restaurants that can keep up with their demand locally, but we have to seek a little farther this time of year.
Now, Beola, I have a question for you. What has been like the most exciting part of your job so far here as an intern at Roberta's?
This
radio interview, awesome.
Yeah. So I've been here 2 days. The first day what did I do first day? I looked up, I learned a lot more about composting and mm-hmm. because I wrote up a report on composting, and today I've been replanting the seedlings, the lettuce.
From last year?
No, it's lettuce seedlings that we planted about a month ago, and she's transplanting them for us into different beds in our hothouse, so they'll grow faster.
Okay, kind of like when we had the propagation station about a year ago. Is that like the same thing?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Basically, with transplanting, you start seeds in one area, and you kind of plant them densely, and then you transplant them to space them out or to move them to a different location.
Allow their roots to grow a little more, and that's when mm-hmm. they really start to become the crop that you want them to turn into.
Exactly.
All right, wonderful. So are you going to be helping with like more of the research of deciding like what kinds of crops they're going to grow? Or I know you already said like you pretty much know what you're going to have, but I mean, have you sourced seeds yet and things of that nature?
We've already bought the seeds, and something that Beola has been helping us with is figuring out when we need to plant and what crops need to be sown directly outside and what crops we're going to start indoors. She put together a nice spreadsheet for me the other day.
Nice. Well, that definitely helps. So what has like the biggest challenge been so far?
That's a good question. I think this winter was a lot colder than we expected. We thought our greenhouses would hold up better against the frost, and there were a couple of weeks there where there was just very little we could do. So we ended up insulating quite a bit, and we've got some heaters going now for our seedlings. But we learned a valuable lesson about how cold New York gets in the winter. I always kind of thought it was milder than it actually is.
Well, I think it kind of has been milder, to be honest. We're having a little longer and more extreme winter than we have in the past couple of years. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come right back. You're listening to the Heritage Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. And stay tuned. All right, and we are back with the Heritage Farm Report. Gwen actually had to run up to the roof. You know, sunlight is of the essence right now, and we're about to lose it here. So we had to say goodbye to Gwen on the break, but she will be back again to talk more about the farm in the future. So now we have all of our guests here from Montreal. I have Mehdi Brunette Benkriti to my left.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Happy to have you. We've got Oog Kafour here as well. And then we have Gael Serf here to my right. Hi. So we are talking with the current sous chef Mehdi of Pide Cochon and the Cabane à Sucre, which I am so excited to talk about. For you that don't speak French, that is the Sugar Shack part of the restaurant au Pide Cochon. Hugh is the former sous chef and partner of the restaurant I just mentioned. And Gael, to my right, is the former front of the house manager and partner as well. So I kind of just want to learn a little bit more about what this whole au Pied de Cochon is and how it relates to the Sugar Shack or the Cabane à Sucre.
Yeah, about the shack. You know, we decided it was a surprise. Like it started from Martin, which is the who's the chef owner. And it was a dream for him to get to have a shack, and he had this opportunity after many years of looking around trying to find a shack, and it's a huge thing to take over. So you just don't go online and find a shack, you know. And so they ended up winning at an auction, so the Sugar Shack, so they entered all the forest and stuff.
Wow.
So yeah.
So I mean, when you say won it at an auction, was it an existing Sugar Shack that someone put up for sale?
Yeah, it was a Sugar Shack. It was basically falling apart. We had no electricity at that time, no gas, nothing at all. And all the pipeline was also not halfway inexistent. So we had to pull everything together and start from scratch. Actually,
now, was the Sugar Shack associated with the restaurant before the restaurant existed, or was this something that happened afterwards?
It happened
on the sixth year, actually.
The sixth year.
Yeah.
Okay. So is it in close proximity? Because obviously, if you won this real estate at an auction or this shack at an auction, it probably wasn't just in your backyard.
It was at that time quite a challenge to bring all the people, but to think about opening a place which was far kind of far from the city, but we're talking about 45 minutes, but it's way out in the countryside, so people would have to move from the city because they were we had targeted those people from the city to come over because it was more kind of a high-end Sugar Shack, you know. We would serve foie gras and stuff like that. And but it worked out.
All right. Well, now that we know the association, let's learn a little bit more about what exactly a Sugar Shack is. Because you say you have to recruit people from the city. I'm assuming that means that it's a special thing to come to a Sugar Shack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of our tradition. We have to go sometimes in spring. We have to go to pay ourselves a treat to go to Sugar Shack. Most of them, you go only once a year because it's enough. It's too much sugar, obviously, because everything is cooked with maple syrup, from the eggs to the bacon, baked beans. Everything is soaked up with syrup, and people would just it's also the first thing we would harvest, after we craved all winter long, nothing happening up there. It's freezing cold. There's a lot of snow, and then all of a sudden the snow's melting. We see the sun coming, and people just they pack the car with the kids. They would go out, and the minute they see smoke coming out of the rooftops, they would stop and
want to know what's going on.
What's going on? Can we stop and have a meal?
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering, because I know that I first start seeing maple syrup here in New York not until like the fall. So is it true that the season for maple syrup does start now as we get into the spring months? Maybe Mehdi, you could answer that for me.
Of course. Well, actually, the the sap from the trees start leaking after cold, from cold to warm temperatures. So you have need cold nights, and then when it gets warm in the day, then it really leaks. And then you can actually start boiling the syrup and having maple syrup.
So being like a chef and everything, I mean, what is your role in actually making the maple syrup? Are you also kind of a harvester of the syrup at the same time? Or is that a whole another group of people that are involved in that process?
Well, not necessarily. I think it's a completely other profession.
Ah.
And the fact that Martin did it and associated it with a restaurant, I think is something fairly new.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if someone else did it. I've never heard of it. And to bring, it's kind of this famous restaurant that's in the city, to bring it in the country and to make it very eventful and to bring a lot of crowd and a different crowd, because now you have children, families and everything going for the same reasons, but also a lot of foodies.
Right. It's that similar, you know, farm to table thing that we talk about here a lot on this network.
Absolutely.
It's using what you're producing in your own recipes and at your restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And actually, you know, there's a great wine list, and it's a little later, and people staying in later. Yeah. They don't just go and have
the taffy.
That's
the big deal. Usually it comes like at the very end of the meal. You would pour, like, you would cook down syrup till a certain degree, and it thicken up, and then you just pour the syrup in the snow, and as it solidifies, you just roll it with a stick.
Oh, no way.
And it's a candy, like it's a maple.
So you're literally using the land as part of your production. Like you are taking from the tree.
Oh, yeah, you're taking advantage of all you have around, all the elements.
Wow. And the kids are crazy about it.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what the kids want. And then
sounds like fun.
Everybody leaves.
It's also a party. You know, people would go have a walk in the wood. Kids would play hockey outside in the mud because the snow's melting, and it's not paved, obviously, so it's a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, you said you won this place, and it wasn't in the best condition. I mean, what did you have to do to like, you know, get the land around and to get the shack really up and running so that you could produce the maple syrup?
You know, first we started, like, we had to make sure that we would be able to collect the sap from the trees. So that was the most important thing to think about and figure out.
How did we know that there would be some sap in that tree?
Trees, they're going to sap eventually. It depends on the weather. But you got to, you know, back then they used to tap the trees and put like, 10 buckets. But obviously when it comes to like 2,500 trees, I mean, you can do that because you have to run like, you know, every 2 hours. When it's sapping, it goes like real fast.
Huh.
And so to tap all the trees, and now we got like pipelines with tubes.
Hmm.
So the tubing are all connected together in a vacuum, and to have like, huge reservoir where you can collect the sap before getting boiled, and like you get to have wood. Some people will use gas or oil, but we did that just like in the whole time
with
using
wood,
like wood burner, maple syrup boiler.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have 2,500 trees with holes in them, with pipes hooked up to the trees, which then leak all of the sap into one reservoir, and we take that sap, and the next step is that it gets boiled over a wood-burning fire. Is that correct?
Totally. Totally, you're right.
Wow.
That's correct.
And now, after this boiling process, is that when it has to be hardened? I mean, does it ever have to be hardened, or was that just for the lollipops?
Oh, yeah. No, after that, it's just like sugar. It's just like sugar. You can keep cooking it down and like you make candy. But it's the most part of the production goes for syrup. So we have to filter it and then to can it.
Right. I mean, I know that
we use can, not like
those plastic bottles
and neither glass jar and stuff like that. It's traditionally in Quebec, it's canned.
Really? And now, are there different grades of the syrup? I mean, you just mentioned something about consistency and stuff like that. And I know here we have grade A and grade B. Is that the same in Canada as well?
Yeah, and they get like four grades, if I'm not mistaken. And it's all about color of the syrup.
Okay.
And it's a little weird because back then the government in Quebec did that because they wanted people to sterilize and to clean their equipment. So the syrup would be clearer, by the way, so they would pay more. But not necessarily the clearest one would be the best one. You know, it's not true.
Oh, okay.
I prefer when it's darker.
Okay.
It has more taste. It's tastier.
Kind of like a wine, right? A more heavy-bodied wine sometimes has a little more flavor than one of your lighter red
wines.
Kind of.
It's kind of the wine of the pores.
It's not when it's cleaner that it's tastier necessarily.
Okay. Awesome. Well, what are some of your favorite things to use maple syrup on or in the restaurant? I mean, obviously you say you have maple syrup in everything, but what are some of the favorites, fan favorites, chef favorites? Maybe Gael would... No, since you're in the front of the house, you get some of the customer feedback.
Yeah, of course. Everybody's used to getting that in desserts mostly, but there have been really interesting dishes that have been created in the restaurant with maple syrup too. I'm talking about the plug à Champlain mostly.
Yeah, totally. You should explain.
That was a really, really amazing dish. It's a buckwheat pancake with lard and old cheddar
and foie gras,
potatoes.
Yeah,
sounds like the best breakfast
ever. Maple syrup sauce.
Good. Yeah. And the maple syrup sauce. So,
that was
winner.
Served as an appetizer, but it's like a whole meal in itself, actually.
Roasted pork. Anything with fat in it is good, and roasted pork glazed with maple syrup is very, very tasty. It really gets really sticky and sweet, and it's very delicious.
Now, do you use maple syrup all year round, or do you find that, like, do you run out of it at any point and have to wait until the next harvest?
Oh, we do, eh? We had last year was not such a bad year, but I know 2 years ago was terrible. And at the restaurant, before the shack was happening, we were using about half a gallon a week, something, maybe a little less than that, but about 5-6 liters a week. And as it got to after Christmas, after January, the stocks were getting very, very low.
Mm.
And let's say we'd pay $50 for 4 liters. It went up to $80. It was one of the most expensive things on the menu, although we carried foie gras and beautiful fish and anything that's of good quality. So to have it is it's a lot of money to get it started, but it pays off in the end.
Definitely. I mean, it's definitely really exciting. I'm wondering, how much of a yield do you get out of one harvest?
Yeah, I mean, it seems a lot, and of course it is a lot, but you need 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup.
No so way. It's a lot, yeah. Oh, man. No. And now why is that? It's just the way it breaks down or the sugar?
Because it's all about the sugar contents in the sap. So you have to bring it to a certain degree. So that also means to concentrate the sugar to have a syrup.
Now, do you have to like know a lot about the actual trees themselves to know how much sap you can expect to get out of a tree? Like, does the age of the tree matter?
Definitely the age of the tree. Also, the kind. There's many kinds of maple, but like sugar maples has like the best yield so far. And you know, sometimes you can tap like a big tree two or three times. So for sure,
and does
it's
going
to get
that,
more sap.
Does that mean there's going to be two or three different holes in it?
That's it.
Okay.
That's
Is there a certain point within the tree, like, you know, low to the ground, high up near the branches that you tap?
It doesn't really matter. The thing is, the only thing is, there's a lot of snow. So you don't want your pipeline to be totally buried in snow.
No.
So you would go like 4 feet up from the ground. You would start and you would go around. Every year you go around by like 2 inches and you keep going like that. And then you can go up and then go down again after like a certain
a certain
number of years. Yeah.
All right. Wonderful. Well, we're going to have the name of the restaurant and the website where you can go to learn a little bit more about the Sugar Shack and the restaurant so that you can also go visit on the website for today's program. We're so excited. I'm so excited to have, you know, these wonderful people sitting here with me to teach me a little bit more about the maple syrup industry in Canada and, well, the industry. I mean, more just like your own small industry. It's really great. I mean, that you have, you know, your own product in your own recipes. I mean, that must feel really good to have a part in that and really be able to serve, you know, syrup on your food. And I guess I just have to wrap up the show because we're out of time today, but I wanted to thank you for coming. This is our first international guest here in the studio on the Farm Report. And I'll be joining Nicole Taylor on Hot Grease next Monday to talk about the Georgia Organics Conference, which I mentioned a little bit earlier. And as always, we thank you for listening, and we thank Heritage Foods USA for sponsoring today's program. And as always, you could check our archives out to re-listen to this interview and to check out the website of Au Pied des Cochons and the Sugar Shack. Thank you.